And good afternoon and welcome to Tom Harris USA episode number 64. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, and there's a little bit of snow coming down at the moment. We've had a couple inches of snow overnight, and it's coming down very, very light, very powdery. Good snow for skiing. I wish I could go skiing. Oh, I miss skiing. I've only been skiing once, and I was going to talk about that on the Chris Reardon's live show a few weeks ago, and instead of talking about skiing, we ended up talking about Little House on the Prairie. But that's one of the things that I really wish I could do around here, because, you know, we are in a very flat area here in Chicago. There are no hills or mountains or anything anywhere near here. The nearest skiing is probably up in Wisconsin, and I wouldn't even say that that would be all that great skiing. It's just kind of low hills and that. I did enjoy it. I was actually skiing in Telluride, Colorado in 1999. This was my the first time skiing, and it was with the Ohio University Snowcats, and they, you know, it was a pretty good deal. We had 5 days in Telluride and 4 days worth of lift tickets, so you could ski 4 out of the 5 days that you're there. And the trip was only, I think it was about $200. I mean, it was just incredibly cheap as long as you were going with the university. And as as I was a student at the university at the time, that was pretty cool. And that was 10 years ago now. Good Lord. But, I do enjoy skiing. And, Chris was asking the question, why on earth would anybody do that? Well, it's the same reason why you go sledding, or, you know, moving fast is fun and it's exciting. It's the same reason why people go to amusement parks and, you know, ride roller coasters and so forth. It's fun, and that's why you do it. Of course, Chris doesn't ride roller coasters either, does he? So anyway, well, that's my answer to it. I mean, I do enjoy the whole experience. And for those who don't want to do it because it's too risky, it's like any time you do something like that, there's an element of risk. But as long as you're, you know, somewhat competent in doing it, I don't claim to be any kind of a great skier. I taught myself basically, and it was just a matter of a day that I, you know, from the first time I put my skis on, and by the end of the 4 days of lift tickets, that last day that we were on the slopes, I was actually on the intermediate slopes and not the beginner slope anymore. So that was, I think made pretty good progress. I spent the first day just kind of figuring all the basics out and learning how to stop and all this other nonsense. And then the second day I spent the whole day on the beginner slope and, you know, learned how to do it really properly and avoid hitting things and, you know, basically that. And then, the third day I, about halfway through the day, started doing intermediate stuff, started going on some harder slopes and going down onto some little miniature jumps and things like that. So, I mean, the learning curve is not that bad. And, you know, riding on the ski lift the first few times you do it is a little bit intimidating. But, yeah, generally speaking, the hardest part of riding a ski lift is when you get off, to make sure that you don't fall over in the middle of the ski run and then the next chair comes up behind you and dumps people on top of you. And that's always the danger. Though I wouldn't say it's a serious danger. It's just kind of an annoying danger. Anyway, had some comments on the show here. Doug from Akeley. Doug, good friend of the show. He had a comment on episode number 63. Doug says, very good show. Thank you, Doug. So what makes a hot dog a Chicago-style hot dog? And I went ahead and answered him there, but I'll do it here too, because I understand that not everybody who listens to the show is my Facebook friend. But so what makes a Chicago-style hot dog? Basically, a Chicago-style hot dog is a beef frank. I think that's important. And it's mustard, diced onion, sweet relish, sport peppers, and celery salt. And you serve it on a poppy seed hot dog roll. And that's the Chicago-style hot dogs. Now, optionally, you can put cucumbers on it, but never, ever ketchup. That's not something that Chicago people do. And now, not that I've actually eaten a Chicago-style hot dog myself, but I mentioned this to Doug, and he goes on to say, this makes me think of the speech teacher I had in high school, Stan Dorr. He was also the head of the drama department. And he and his wife also ran a deli called the Stage Door, and they had 99 ways to fix a hot dog. That sounds pretty cool. I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously the variations are endless, like burgers. And we actually have some in a fancy burger joints here in Chicago, and I've never been to them, but I know about them, that do all these really fancy burgers and combinations of burgers and hot dogs. But they're actual, like, sit-down type restaurants. Not you know, fancy or anything, but they're kind of a pubby atmosphere and so forth. And Chicago is a very good foodie town, I have to say, even for people like me who don't eat meat. So thanks, Doug, for your comment. It's very kind of you to write in the show. I always like hearing from you. Have an email here from Scott Mitchell from the Scott Podcast Uncommon Sense. You can go to scottpodcast.com and listen to Scott's show. But Scott had a link. A few shows back, I was talking about psychic predictions and kind of my review of the psychic predictions that I did for 2009 and 2010. And I, in the process of this, I had asked about, psychics to check out, to look at their predictions. And, Scott had this to say. He says, "Hello, Tom. On your podcast, you asked if there were any other psychics we wanted you to look over. Well, here's one. He's not a psychic, nor does he claim to be one." Well, I guess he's not really a psychic, is he? "He considers himself to be a science and news-based prediction expert. Read below on him and his recent predictions. I would love to hear you analyze this." And he sends me to a Wikipedia page for a man named Gerald Salente. And I've heard of this guy before. He does a lot of not really predictions. What he does is he does trend forecasting. So he bases his analysis on trends that he sees in the business world. He's more of a business guy. And he talks about financial markets and he talks about politics a little bit. But he claims to have predicted the 1987 stock market crash, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and there's a lot of things. Now, what is really interesting is that I looked back on his records, and he really isn't, he's not completely accurate. And I think the reason why is because he's a trend forecaster, and trends change. So basically what Salente does is he looks at a situation and say, okay, this is the way the markets are heading. This is the trend of this particular segment of the financial industry. And he goes in and he says, okay, well, if it keeps going like this, this is going to happen. So it is in a very real sense an educated guess. You know, say, well, this is how it's going now. If it keeps going like this, X is going to happen. Or this is what is likely to happen. So it isn't quite the same as a psychic prediction, because a psychic, you know, is going to make a prediction based on woo. And based on, you know, whatever feelings they have. And this guy doesn't trade in feelings. This guy trades in trends. And yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. But what I'm finding as I look back at the predictions he's made is that they're extremely vague. And even the things that he says that he got right, that he foresaw, these trends, they're not trends that are surprising. You know, given the course of what he was predicting, you know, they are generally a logical extension of what he was talking about. I mean, the trends have continued to go this way. This will happen. He does come up with very rational arguments. However, one of the things that I think is very notable about this guy's predictions, he does tend to be a doomsayer. That is the position that he takes. So he's basically picking the worst case scenario in almost every case. And therefore, he's gonna be right sometimes. You know, I'm looking back at some of his old predictions and some of the things that he claims to have predicted. He claimed to have predicted 9/11. But I look back at the prediction and it doesn't say anything about us being attacked. It just says that in 2001 there will be, you know, a continued rise in anti-Americanism overseas. Really? You know, is that not something that's been coming forever? I mean, you know, the U.S. has been interfering in the internal affairs of other countries since the 1800s. It's nothing new, you know. So, you know, in one hand, you know, he claims to have predicted 9/11, but he didn't. You know, the rise in anti-American activity when our American interests are interfering overseas so extensively. I mean, that's not a rocket science. I mean, that's a pretty obvious prediction. Now, I do find his analysis of American behavior in this article to be very interesting because he actually is taking a very realistic point on this and isn't taking a politically correct or a jingoistic view of America as it pursues its own interests. So there is something of value in here, but you really can't strictly say that he predicted X or Y or Z because he deals in generalities. And that was what a lot of his predictions are. They're very, very general. They're very nonspecific. And of course, the more nonspecific you go, the more likely you are to be able to claim a hit. This is one of the things I talked about when I was talking about psychic predictions back in episode 11. The vaguer your prediction, the better if you want to have a good track record. Even so, I don't think that we have seen, looking back at this article from 2001, that the world has rejected Americanism in all of its permutations. There's still a lot of people out there who want American-style entertainment, who want American-style culture, who, you know, respect the American lifestyle, you know, and they want that sort of thing for themselves. Now, things have changed a little bit now that, you know, we have this worldwide economic recession, but I don't think they've changed that much. So, I mean, you know, it's these changes aren't staggering in their scope, and that seems to be what he is assuming in this article from December of 2000 is going to happen, is that there's going to be whole-scale rejection of America and everything it stands for. And that hasn't happened. So, you know, so Gerald, you know, Celente, I mean, he's not as accurate as all that. However, you know, again, it's apples and oranges. It really is a very different thing. And, you know, and people like this, they do perform a valuable service. They're not out there, well, if they're not out there scaremongering. And that is another point, is that, you know, you can argue that some of this guy's stuff is scaremongering. And in particular, what he's talking about now, he's been doing a lot of appearances on, you know, right-wing TV shows, though he doesn't, yeah, I'm looking at his stuff and he doesn't seem to have much of a political bent to it. He doesn't really talk about, you know, partisan politics in any kind of way. So it's really kind of hard to tell what his political viewpoint is. And that's okay. That actually is probably good because it means that he's going to be more objective analytically over the kind of the spectrum of economic activity. Now, he does say on this Wikipedia page, it says he describes himself as a political atheist. So a complete non-political viewpoint of things. I find it hard to refute that from the few articles I've read. But, you know, I think it's going to depend, you know, which side of the political spectrum is going to pick up on his predictions is going to depend on what he's predicting and whether one side or the other can blame the other for it. I think that's where he comes from. So thanks, Scott. That was very interesting reading up on this guy and some of his articles. If you're interested in reading some of his predictions, you can go to www.trendsresearch.com, all one word. I've had an interesting email exchange in the last few days with Robert in Iceland, our good friend in Iceland, Robert Pels. And before I go on and talk about this, I need to play you a clip, and this is from the United Kingdom Talk program with Chris Reardon, because this will help put this conversation into context. I did edit this slightly for length.
First of all, from Tom Harris, who hosts the podcast, TomHarrisUSA.com. He was questioning Robert's elves. You know, Robert in Iceland, because he's got elves. Oh yes, he's got his very own elves. I did, in fact, attempt to question the local elves. He says, actually, I think they were part of the Chicago Brotherhood of Elves, Union Local number 773. Trying to ascertain just how Robert, an admitted non-elf, could possibly have become King of the Elves. I see your point here, Tom. How can you have a non-elf become King of the Elves? Tom says, the reaction of the elves was to mutter darkly and fling lutefisk at me. He says, something seems to be very fishy there. Could Robert have possibly enslaved the local elf population of Iceland and forced them to live behind his stairs? We know he has an elf butler, Smarty Pants. Does he have other elf slaves? Inquiring minds want to know. Well, that's very interesting. You should say, do you think Robert in Iceland is luring elves into a false sense of security? Is that what's going on there? Worth a thought, isn't it? Tom says, a lutefisk is a particular nasty Scandinavian dish. Oh, I mean, all that blooming food they eat in Iceland sounds absolutely vile, doesn't it? Whales and fish things. He says, it consists of white fish or cod fillets soaked in lye until it reaches a jelly-like consistency. Oh, how vile does that sound? That sounds like jellied eels. There are actually people in the UK who eat jellied eels. And I've seen them, and they look the most vile things that you've ever discovered in your life. Almost a bit like eating those cockles and whelks. Sticking them in with a little pin thing and eating them out of the shell. Oh, no. Tom says it's very popular in places where there are a lot of Norwegians and Swedish people. I mean, their breath must stink, mustn't it? It's not quite as gross as hakarl, which is an Icelandic midwinter delicacy, consisted of putrefied shark meat left buried in the ground for 6 to 8 weeks. Oh, it makes me make my stomach turn, this is. But certainly unpleasant in the same tradition. And is no doubt rare here in the States because of the relative lack of sharks in our colder regions. Oh, how vile. They do eat some very strange things in the Scandinavian countries, I tell you that now.
So this is where that thread kind of got started here. So the day after this aired, I got this email, and I think Chris got it too, from Robert Pels. He goes, Chris and dear friends of United Kingdom Talk, lutefisk is a Norwegian dish and a rather tasty one too, and the putrefied shark is oh so yummy. But he attaches an official notification from the Office of the King of the Elves. UN Resolution 101, confirmation of action to be taken against persons who are perceived a threat to the elves. UN special authorization from the Security Council. It has come to the attention of His Knobbiness that you have been abusing your position on the wireless thingy to cast assertions about his right to the position of King of the Elves. He was appointed this role because of the love and devotion that the elves hold for him who must be obeyed. Upon placing his foot upon the land of Iceland, he was recognized as their leader, and the one foretold in the Norse sagas. His bloodline can be traced as a direct link to Odin and Thor. One should warn Tom Harris that he must be careful not to walk this path of disrespect, or the elves will act, and that goes for you also. We have elves in Australia too, clever clogs. His mantle of grey hair is a sign of great wisdom and learning, noted for its luster, which sparkles under an Icelandic moon. Well, that sounds like he's throwing down the gauntlet. Now, I had to ask you this. Now, I agree, a mantle of great hair is a sign of great wisdom. And I share that, Robert. My hair would sparkle under an Icelandic moon as well. Anyway, I responded to Robert with this. I said, Robert, not sure if you know this, but I can also trace my lineage back to Odin. Robertette replied, Dear Tom, I'm sure you can trace your lineage back to Odin. However, I'm talking about Odin from the Norse sagas and not the guy in the deli at the mall. I beg your pardon. We don't have people named Odin working in the deli here. No, that's an Icelandic thing. No, that's not the way it works. No, I was talking also about the Norse god Odin as documented in the Icelandic sagas. And I have documentation. Don't make me whip out my documentation, because I will, sir. I got a reply from Robert. Dear Tom, really, I think those cold, who am I trying to kid? I live in Iceland, for heaven's sakes. Cold, dark days of the far north of America, or as it should be known, Bandarikyunum, have thee befuddled. For indeed it is known also to those that have the gift that one shall come from the west and lay claim to the throne of the elves. However, according to my records, you be what we call a usurper, and I challenge thee to mortal combat and following the time-honored weapon's choice of French stick or baguette. Oh, it appears that I may have to give thee a bready smackdown there, Sir Robert. But honestly, because I have a bloodline that I can trace back to Odin and to Baldur of the Norse sagas, doesn't mean that I want to be king of the elves. I'm no usurper. I don't want to be king of the elves, because that would make me a hypocrite. Because even though I am descended from the Aesir themselves, I am not an elf, and how can a non-elf be king of the elves? Maybe the answer is to give elves self-determination, and in fact, I have been contacted by a mysterious elf. I don't know exactly who this is, but he goes by the name of Winky and claims to represent a group called the Elven Liberation Front. And to quote Winky, he says, I didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective. So the way I see it is we should free the elves from their slavery. Now, that doesn't mean, Robert, that you can't have elf servants. But you have to pay them. You can't make them, force them to work for you for free and live under the stairs. You have to give them their own room and your house and pay them something. You know, pay them, I don't know, do they like lutefisk? You can pay them in lutefisk. I agree with Chris Reardon there. The whole idea of the lutefisk and Hakarl and ugh, it sounds really, really disgusting. Now I do eat seafood, so I don't have any particular problem with fish, but and I'm pretty adventurous when it comes to food. I really do like trying different kinds of things. Though I don't know if I'd be particularly interested in trying Hakarl. That does sound pretty disgusting, if you ask me. Now, of course, I was reading up on that, and looking. And the reason why they bury it in the ground, folks, the reason why they bury the shark meat in the ground is because the sharks in that part of the ocean are actually poisonous to eat, and they have to bury the fillets in the ground in order to leach the poison out. And then it takes like 6 to 8 weeks before the poison is leached out enough to make it safe to eat. That seems a bit risky to me, doesn't it? But I'm sure that, you know, it's a delicacy. It's one of those things that you kind of wonder who was the first person to try that. It does seem like a very, not a very logical way of coming up with a foodstuff. But I imagine when the first settlers came to Iceland, and they probably didn't have a whole lot of choice. They probably didn't have a lot to eat. But I would love to go to Iceland. And I think I probably have said this before, that Iceland, you know, the pictures I've seen and everything I know about Iceland, which is not huge amount, but, you know, Robert can educate us. But I would really love to go there. I would really love to see Iceland and explore it. It looks like an absolutely gorgeous place. You know, the hot springs and the mountains and the fjords, and it does sound amazing. Now, there's actually a movie And I haven't been able to find it on DVD, and I think it never was released on DVD in the States. And it was never released on video in the States, on VHS either. But it was a movie that I saw in an art theater. It was a... No, Irving, and no, not that kind of an art theater. Now, I saw it at a movie theater in Cleveland that showed a lot of foreign films. And the film is actually a joint production of the Icelandic Film Board and the Japanese Film Board. And it was called Cold Fever. And it took place in Iceland. And it was about a Japanese guy who has to give up his golf vacation in Hawaii to go to Iceland and do a ceremony for, a Shinto ceremony for his parents who had died in an accident, in the Icelandic countryside. And, just a beautiful, gorgeous movie, and unfortunately I haven't been able to find it since. But, yeah, I really would like to visit Iceland, so maybe Robert can pay for me to come to Iceland and visit and meet his elves. That would be exciting. Of course, he probably won't do that because he's probably afraid that I'm going to agitate them and make them strike or something. Start an elf rebellion. Yeah, I'm guessing that probably isn't possible, but I guess we'll find out someday. Anyway, Robert, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to hearing from you again. Well, speaking of movies, Pete and I went to go see a movie this week. We went to go see the new Sherlock Holmes film with Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law. Interesting film. Now, I usually talk about, you know, comic-related movies on the show when I see them, but I'm going to mention this one. It was better than I expected, but it was still very fantastic in a lot of ways. And I was really impressed by, not so much the story. The story was kind of mundane and formulaic to a point. But they take on Holmes was very, very interesting because they didn't do anything that was really out of character per se. But they definitely darkened it up a little bit, and the world of Victorian London, as they portray it in the film, was definitely, he went for this hyper-realistic, really gritty, dirty London, which I suspect is probably, you know, closer to the truth than any other production of Sherlock Holmes. But of course, you know, because you have to tailor a movie to the audience, to the actual, you know, movie-going public of your day. I mean, you know, the old Sherlock Holmes movies, you know, it seemed very sedate and very boring in comparison. But I thought they did a good job with it, and they had some wonderful set work and some wonderful scenery in there. And I quite enjoyed it. And of course, they took all of the characters who are in that were taken from the original Holmes stories, even the ones that we kind of thought about, well, maybe they were, you know, maybe these were invented for the movie. Well, it turned out that they weren't. They were actually, Arthur Conan Doyle characters that they sort of translated over into the movie universe, which of course is a little bit different. Now, I noticed that I was reading an article before we saw the movie on the, I think it was one of the news sites like CNN.com or something, where the big Sherlock Holmes fan club was talking about how they kind of approve of this take on Sherlock Holmes, and the reason why is because of Jude Law's portrayal of Watson. And I agree with that. They portrayed Watson as very much a maybe not an equal to Holmes, but certainly in his way an equal to Holmes. And somebody who was not a bumbling idiot like Nigel Bruce in the old movies from the 40s. So I think it's well worth a look, and especially if you're a Holmes fan, it may not be exactly what you expect, but at the same time, it's not bad. So, anyway, it's worth a look. Anyhow, I'm running short on time now. As always, I love to hear from people. If you want to email the show, the email address is tom@tomharrisusa.com. So, that's about all for now. I'll see you next time from Tom at Tom Harris USA. Have a great week, and I'll see you in episode number 65. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, signing off.